We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning. I am Giselle Atterbury, your guest host this morning. And today's topic is Frank Lloyd Wright. With me in the studio is Elizabeth Dunbar, president of Wright and Kankakee, a new not-for-profit group that has made it possible for the public to have access to this wonderful early example of Wright's Prairie-style architecture.
Good morning.
Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
Also with us by phone is Thomas A. Hines, architect, photographer, and Wright scholar, who's published extensively on Wright. Hines is perhaps best known for his widely praised regional field guides to Frank Lloyd Wright's buildings. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
It's good to hear from you. I should let everyone know that phone numbers for the show are 333-9455 and 800-222-9455 for folks out of the area. You are also welcome to join the discussion by email. That is will-talk@illinois.edu. So once again, good morning, Elizabeth, and we've talked briefly earlier. I am just amazed at this very intensive volunteer effort to get this house open to the public. What made you do this?
It's really been a collaborative effort and a labor of love over the past 5 years, both on the part of our volunteer group and on the part of Gaines and Sharon Hall. They purchased the property in 2005 really with the intent to save it, and they always had a vision to open it to the public. And so thanks to their very amazing restoration that they've done on the home, we were able to purchase the home from them and open it. So I think there was always a feeling in the community about this house. There's a connection to this house in the community. It's been through so many incarnations and so many different uses, and I think people, they've always appreciated it. There's always been a little bit of mystery around the house, and now it's just an amazing feeling to have it open to the public.
It's just a wonderful thing for Kankakee and the surrounding area, and congratulations on that. Tom, would you be willing to let our listeners know exactly why this Bradley House is so significant to the early career of Frank Lloyd Wright?
It was the first of its kind. Before this, Frank Lloyd Wright's designs and buildings were slightly more conventional. In fact, if you saw many of them, you wouldn't think they were Frank Lloyd Wright design buildings. This house is a very simple stucco house. It's very low to the ground. If you look in the rest of the neighborhood that the Bradley House is in, you'll see most of the houses are 50% taller, and some of them are double tall. And the very simple surfaces, the very geometric windows. This house, when it was built in 1900, I would say, if you talk to the neighbors at the time, not knowing, of course, who this is, they would say this is a George Jetson house. This is a house from the future. We don't know anything about it. It's so completely different. I don't know why more wasn't written about the strange building on South Harrison Street, but it didn't seem to appear in the newspapers very often. But it's the first of what we now call Wright's Great Period, the Prairie Period.
It is absolutely a spectacular house, inside and out. It's beautifully situated on the river. I can imagine that Frank Lloyd Wright must have smiled broadly when he first saw that site and imagined the home there, because he was so sensitive to the situation of his buildings. Next door is the Hickox House.
Yes.
And, of course, anybody who's been through art history or art appreciation has probably had to memorize both the Bradley House and the Hickox House for slide tests.
Right.
And it's such a pleasure to have the Bradley House open. The Hickox House is not.
It's privately owned, yes.
Right, but nothing to stop you from walking along the walkway and having a glance at that. Elizabeth, for visitors who are interested in arriving at the home, how can they get further information about planning a tour?
The best way for information is on our website, writeinkankakee.org. We regularly post our hours. We do have regular hours on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays when the house is open, and we do have a gift shop as well that's open those days. That's the best way for information. Our phone number, if you prefer to phone, is 815-936-9630.
Okay, thanks. And again, having been on a tour myself, I can say that the docent was very well prepared, and we were allowed to linger a bit in areas that interested us the most, and just a very delightful experience. So again, congratulations on that. Tom, I'm sure you're very familiar with the house through the years. You helped the Hall family in restoring the home, and I don't know whether to gush first about the exterior or the interior, but I think I'd start with the great room, the living room, so to speak, and the tremendous fireplace. What is just hallmark right about that space?
Well, we've discovered over the years, and I've worked on a lot of Frank Lloyd Wright buildings, but I've studied more than I've worked on. And the living room in the Bradley House is about 27 by 24 feet, which is a large room in any building. But it seems to be the standard for what Frank Lloyd Wright used throughout his lifetime, his 70-year career. I don't know what was interesting or magical about the size of that room, but there's a house in Highland Park, the Willis House, 24 by 27. The Cheney House in Oak Park is 24 by 27. The Coonley House, 1907, 1908 in Riverside is 24 by 27. There's something about that he liked. I don't know what it is.
The proportions are very gracious. And for our listeners, would you describe the impact of color, the woodwork, the brickwork, please?
It's a very, what we today wouldn't be outstanding because his ideas have carried over into all kinds of builders' houses as well as architect design buildings. But the floor is a oak strip floor. It's mostly quarter sawn oak. It has a built-in seat in the bay window that extends out towards the street. The walls have an integral color into the plaster. Color was actually mixed in, and that's something I think he got from Japanese architecture, where they would mix in different color sands. They'd even mix in hay and straw to give certain textures. All of the wood in the house, except for the servants' rooms, is also oak. And the fireplace is a very hard-burned sort of dark brown brick with oak trim on it. There were also, in the ceiling, there are trim boards that run across the ceiling. The top of the windows and the top of all the doors throughout the building are about 6'8", and there's what we call now a headband that ties the top of those all together in a big horizontal line. So the room seems bigger than it is, and it also, what we say, has borrowed spaces. There are alcoves and large openings to this room. There's two areas towards the street that have bookshelves in them. One was called a library. I forget now what the name of the other one was. But towards the entry, towards the reception room, towards the hallway, which is behind the fireplace, all very large, generous openings. So again, the scale is kind of throwing people off. It's ceilings over 9 feet high. And there's a band of plaster around that, just underneath the ceiling, that's the same color as the ceiling. So it kind of brings the coloring down, and it's an experience that you have to have in person, because photographs just don't do the place justice.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and Elizabeth is nodding her head yes as well. You really must see it, and it's breathtaking, and it's also a bit mysterious. You talked about the borrowed spaces. There's a complexity to the architecture, and of course you enter that space, and you enter from a ceiling height that is lower, so you have this wonderful, open, gracious, expansive space. And it's not closed out from the outside world. There's just really, I think, some of Wright's most remarkable stained glass or colored glass in that home. And that's part of the total experience, too. Would you, Elizabeth, like to describe the glass?
Yeah, just one comment, too, about
sure.
the space. Tom mentioned the borrowed space. And I think at the Bradley House, that concept is remarkable in that it carries the eye in every room you're in. It carries your eye to the river. The house is not situated to face the river, and yet the long hallways and the borrowed space guide the eye continually back toward the river. And that huge space, as a social historian, I look at it as beyond just the architecture, but affecting the way that the Bradleys would have lived in that space. It was very different from a Victorian home that had small parlors and dining areas and sort of more enclosed spaces. This would have really changed the way that the family interacted with each other. So just a comment there about space. It's not just remarkable in the exterior architecture and the change that Wright brought about when he designed this house. He really changed the way in which people lived in it.
Exactly. And then the room just above that, I thought, I had all sorts of questions after leaving the house. How would you really use that room? I can imagine a multitude of ways.
Right.
But the Bradley family that lived in it, if my understanding is right, it was really a multi-generational family that moved into the house originally.
It was. The Bradleys built the house. Harley and Anna were only 30 and 33, very young couple to build this extraordinary home.
And Wright was about the same age.
He was 33. Interestingly enough, the Hickox family was Anna's brother that built the Hickox house next door, and they were only 23. So it was really a group of, you know, this radical design was going on with a lot of youngsters, so to speak, in this very established historic neighborhood. The room above the living room that you're speaking of was for the elder Bradleys. That was their living suite. And so it was really designed with two master suites. The Bradleys had theirs on the first floor, and his parents had the suite above them. And it's an amazing space as well, which also overlooks the river from another bay window. Back to your question about the windows, we have amazing art glass in our house. We're missing some of the most amazing pieces because they've been sold off over the years, some of the interior pieces. But the exterior art glass, I think, in that living room space is some of the most compelling glass that I've seen. Because of its simplicity, not because of its intricacy. We only have two colors in our glass, red and white. It's a stylized tulip, but he draws this linear pattern upward and across, and it just makes this amazing design. And the way the light plays through that design at all times of the day is just incredible.
Very elegant. And Tom,
most of the leading in those windows is either horizontal or vertical, but where there are diagonals, it matches the pitch of the roof.
Yes, I had heard you mention that before, and it is a small design detail that so integrates the experience of the whole. I can't be enthusiastic enough about encouraging people to take the opportunity to go inside this home.
Yeah.
It's really so much more than even what would be suggested from the exterior. Now, the house has not always had such a lovely life as being open to the public. Would you like to, Elizabeth, tell us about some of the previous owners and, again, thankfully, the Hall family and their efforts, please?
Sure. The Bradley family actually only lived in the home for about 13 years, 12 to 13 years. They moved in the summer of 1901 when it was completed, and by 1913 they had moved. It was briefly owned by another owner, and then in 1915, Joseph Dodson purchased the house. He's a really colorful character, president of the National Audubon Society. He built birdhouses out of the stable, really interesting guy, and he was there till 1949. In 1953, the house ended its first life as a private residence and became the Yesteryear Restaurant and Inn, and many people from the area, even Champaign and Chicago and the whole regional area, remember the Yesteryear as this very gracious, very excellent restaurant till 1983 when it closed. And then the house went through a couple of owners and some tragedies and then became law offices. And the space was adapted for offices, conference rooms, things like that. The stable was never included in that adaptation, that reuse, and so it fell into disrepair. And in 2004, there was a demolition permit filed for the stable. And of course, any time that a Wright building is threatened, and Tom can probably speak more to this than I can, there is just tremendous outcry, public outcry. And it was at that time that the lawyers who owned the property at the time said they just couldn't afford to renovate and restore the stable, and so they put the house on the market. And that's when Gaines and Sharon Hall purchased the property. Gaines is actually a professor here at U of I now, and he's in class. Otherwise, I would have had him on the phone. And like I said, they just restored it to save it. They really did have a vision for the grandeur of the house and the design, and understood Wright's vision for the house and took that as their own and went back to the original plans and fully restored the stable and the house. And then, like you said, we just acquired it in June.
And their care was obviously extremely meticulous. They had some help with historic photographs,
absolutely,
I understand.
They did.
And paint analysis so that we're at the correct colors today.
Yes. I didn't have any part in it. The Halls and one of the previous owners, Stephen Small, had done plaster samples. And so there was a wealth of information about what was right. And they really went back and tried to make it as original as possible, keeping, you know, modern conveniences. We do have air conditioning, which is really nice. We're very grateful for that. But made very few changes to Wright's original plans and really went back to that vision to restore it to its beauty.
Okay. Now you mentioned air conditioning, but I remember a sleeping porch there. And again, we've talked already about the windows, but the integration of exterior features and interior features is really so sophisticated for this young architect. Mm-hmm. And Tom, I was wondering if you would like to comment at all about, again, we've indicated this is the Prairie School beginning here, but the cruciform plan, are there other features that are just really almost unpredictable from looking at Wright's earlier designs?
Well, this is probably the first house where he does something that he talks about later, which is the integration of the building and the site. He wants to blur the line between the grounds and the structure. And so he puts the porte cochere over the entryway and puts planters out in there, and he pulls the porch out to the front of the house towards the street. And so even though you're surrounded by the building, you're not yet inside the building. And this is really, this house is the first time that happens also. He did other buildings where it's hard to find where the front door is, but when you're standing in the street looking at this building, you don't know where the front door is. All you see is the driveway that goes underneath this roof. So I think it's natural for people to go down there and ultimately find the front door, but it's tucked in behind the little bay window of the reception hall. And so he's bringing all these things in, and with these porches, there are two big porches off to the south side that at the original time were open. They weren't enclosed except for screening on the second floor. But he's trying to integrate the nature and the structure. So he didn't do this before in any other building. So this is such a huge leap for him, and yet he did it so well. It's like this was his 20th or 30th attempt at something because of how it came out. But he was remarkable that way, that something was cooking in his brain and all of a sudden it becomes three-dimensional and people live in it and it's fully complete.
For our listeners who are quite familiar with Frank Lloyd Wright, of course, the doorway to the Dana Thomas House is tucked in along the side. You almost have to search for the entryway to the Roby House unless you know of ahead of time where to find that. So again, yes, it's something that he repeats, and It's really unprecedented. And I think one of the joys of visiting the house in Kankakee, as well as, of course, going up to Oak Park, are the comparisons with the other turn-of-the-century houses, houses of great prestige, great beauty, often extremely well-maintained, but that big front door sort of smacking you in the face, saying, hey, whoever lives here is extremely important, and you know this right at the front door. And for some reason, Wright decided, no, I'm not going to bring the attention to the front door. It's going to be smaller, tucked in, speak more of shelter. And this, again, graciousness, intimacy, a different psychology for that house than anything else in the neighborhood, except, of course, the neighboring Hickox's house. And so, you know, if people are coming to visit, I'm sure you suggest maybe on a nice day they wander a bit through the neighborhood.
Oh, definitely.
As well.
Definitely. We sit on the western edge of the Riverview Historic District, and the district is an amazing, it's like an architectural
textbook.
Yes. It's this neighborhood that developed over a 40 or 50 year period, beginning. Really, it had its beginnings in about 1880 with some early homes, including Warren Hickox Sr., who was Anna and Warren's father, and develops throughout the 30s into the 40s and just has a whole compendium of architectural styles within it. And so the Bradley and Hickox houses sort of form the border of this amazing historic district. And it's so great because I'm able, when I'm giving a tour, I can just point sort of catty corner across the street and say there's this beautiful Victorian just a block away that's of the same era, and this is what people expected in architecture. This is when somebody started building a house. This was, I mean, the Magruder House, of which I speak, got a ton of press because it was this wonderful, magical house that Henry Magruder was building, and it was so lovely. And compared to, as Tom mentioned, the very little press that the Bradley House received when it was built. Because that's what people expected. You know, I think the Bradley and Hickox houses were just so unusual and so unique, people didn't know what to think. But it really, it's so valuable to have those other houses in the context in which these houses were built as a comparison.
Exactly.
Now, Elizabeth didn't mention this, but the Bradleys were in Kankakee because the original client of this house, B. Harley Bradley, his grandfather ran and operated a farm implement business in Chicago and was looking to expand, and Chicago was too expensive. So they were convinced to come to Kankakee and look at this piece of property, and they indeed moved their factory down to what was North Kankakee, and they renamed the town Bradley. And so this is one of the most prominent families, the Bradleys, in the whole area. To have a town named after them was pretty remarkable. And yet, when this house was opened for the first time, there's no press on it. It doesn't really say anything about that they had a reception or a housewarming or anything, or they weren't trying to get any favor from the Bradleys by publicizing this, or maybe the Bradleys didn't want publicity. I don't know, but the upshot of this is we don't even have photographs of the Bradleys.
Oh, dear.
We
can't find anything. Not in any yearbooks, not in the press, not the newspapers, not family, nothing.
It is quite amazing. The Hickox family was also very, very prominent. When Anna Hickox married Harley Bradley, I'm sure we do have a newspaper article about their wedding, and it was quite lovely, and guests were brought down from Chicago, and it was really quite an event because the Hickox family was one of the founders of the Riverview neighborhood. Mr. Hickox owned a bank. He owned a title company. He had large land holdings, including the city block where these houses are built. He owned the whole city block. So very, very prominent families that built these homes. And as Tom said, we have very, very little record of them. And once they sell the house in 1913, the Bradley family disappears from the area. It's almost incredible that there's just very little record of them.
For those of you just tuning in today, I am Giselle Atterbury, a guest host. With me is Elizabeth Dunbar, president of Wright in Kankakee, and the Bradley House is their property, now open to the public. And with us by phone is Thomas A. Hines, who is quite the expert, one of the most renowned experts on the buildings of Frank Lloyd Wright. We're discussing the Bradley House, its neighborhood, it's being open to the public. And Elizabeth, the house is open for more than just architectural tours now. There are other events going on. Why don't you let our listeners know about that?
Oh, definitely. There's been not just an amazing reception in terms of people wanting to take tours of the house. That has been incredible. We've had guests from over 10 foreign countries and 30-some states. I think I lost track of how many states. So just that reception has been wonderful.
But since
July 16th we opened. I think you were on our first
weekend.
Our first tour.
Couldn't help it.
But in addition to that, we, from the very beginning, Wright and Kankakee conceived of this house as more than a stuffy old house museum. We wanted it to be a place very full of life and very open to the community, very open to the public, and very much a resource in the cultural fabric of our community. And so to that end, we have been looking at all different kinds of uses for the house. We like to say that we take very good care of the house, but we don't want it to be so hands-off that people don't enjoy it. So we have held dinners there and receptions, and we'll be hosting an art exhibit in the spring of works based on the house. We're inviting artists to come in and produce works generated by the house and by what they see in the house. And then in addition to that, we've opened the house up to public events such as receptions, weddings, luncheons, board meetings. I have a corporate retreat next week that I'm really looking forward to. One of our local companies is using the house. So we really want people to enjoy the space, and we've had amazing local reception to that concept. We have 5 weddings booked, and more people asking about the use than a volunteer staff can possibly handle, I think.
Well, that's all good news. And you've had excellent reception to the news that the house would be open to the public, the New York Times, Blair Kamen, who's helped you out with that as well. And you've mentioned international visitors have been finding their way.
They do. It's amazing. Wright enthusiasts have a way of... It's almost like telepathy. They know when there's something going on in the Wright world, and there's this huge network of information going on, listservs and all kinds of news searches. And so, as you mentioned, Blair Kamen ran a great piece in the Chicago Tribune in March when we were still trying to raise the funds and trying to work out a purchase acquisition agreement. And then he ran another great piece in June or July. And then Eve Kahn did the piece July 2nd in the New York Times, which was picked up by newspapers all over the country. So we are featured in Modernism magazine this month. It's just been Style 1900 is doing a great piece for this month or next month. I don't know when it's going to run. It's just been incredible. This group of Wright enthusiasts, you know, they've found us, and it's wonderful. And our website gets hits from all over the world. It's amazing.
Now, Tom, for our downstate listeners, we're very fortunate to have the Dana Thomas House also open once again to the public. And would you be willing to make some comparisons between the two homes, please?
Well, seeing that the Bradley House was a very limited budget, it's amazing that Frank Lloyd Wright designed not only both the Hickox and the Bradley House. I kind of always lumped them together. But he designed custom furniture for both houses. And in fact, there's a letter that it was part of an interview, with one of the Hickox children, that there were earlier designs for both houses which were rejected because they were too expensive. So they didn't have all the money in the world that Susan Dana had. And her house, every wall of that house has a different, dramatically different, art glass pattern, stained glass pattern. And she had, for the size of the building, I would say as much furniture originally designed as the Bradley and Hickox houses. Unfortunately, the Bradley and Hickox houses, it's been sold off and dispersed to various museums and individuals, so not in the buildings like the Dana House is. But I would say that the Dana House is a little more conventional in its planning. It doesn't have as same kind of borrowed spaces that the Bradley and Hickox houses have. And so I think maybe it was because Mrs. Dana was a little more conservative, a little more conventional than the Bradleys and the Hickoxes. But Dana House is a spectacular building. And I don't know if anybody who tours the Dana House could imagine themselves living there like they can when they see the Hickox and Bradley houses. Because of the scale, the size, number of rooms, and uses of the rooms, too, I think.
Okay. I believe we have a caller on line one from Urbana. Good morning, caller.
Hey, good morning. I'm more interested in the people than the house, but are the Bradleys the same people connected with the farm manufacturing company that used to be in the Kankakee area that was bought out by Serge Roebuck, or are they connected with the school, the higher education system there?
Thank you. The Bradleys, B. Harley Bradley, who commissioned the house, was the grandson of David Bradley, in fact, the owner of the Bradley Manufacturing Company that built farm implements. And in 1895, they moved their plant to North Kankakee, which became Bradley, Illinois.
No, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And we have a second caller, line two, from Champaign. Good morning.
Hi. That's really interesting to hear about the Wright House, and I've been meaning to get to Bradley to see that one. I grew up in Hyde Park about four blocks from the Roby House, and we used to play hide-and-seek on it.
Oh, my.
Not inside, because we obviously couldn't get inside it, but there was access to the outside of the structure itself, and many, many summer evenings we played hide-and-seek and fort and castle, and I kind of cringe now to think how many times it was climbed on, but I guess it's sturdy. It's still there. This was in the 60s, so I don't even know if kids could do that now. My family since moved to Oak Park, and so it's really nice to see all the right houses there, and we don't climb on them now. So this is very interesting. I'm glad to hear about all this. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thank you. There's so many stories. Because the Bradley House and the Hickox houses are right in the middle of a neighborhood, there are lots of stories about people who grew up right in that vicinity and their memories of it. And every weekend we have people come through, and they particularly remember Joseph Dodson, who built birdhouses there up until 1949. The older residents of the community remember that he was very eccentric, and he was an interesting man, and he didn't like little boys, and he didn't like cats because they hurt his songbirds, and he would shoo them away, but he would let the kids sometimes come in and look at the shop, and he let the house grow up, and he didn't mow, and he didn't cut the shrubs or anything. And so, you know, you can imagine that the neighbors were very interested in this sort of eccentric gentleman. And so there's a lot of stories about that. And then when the restaurant was in the Bradley House for 30 years, of course, the children in the neighborhood probably didn't go to the restaurant itself by themselves, but there were gift shops. And so I've heard a number of people say, oh, as a kid, we would go and bother Marv and Ray and wander around the gift shop. And it's interesting, these houses, I think many of Wright's houses have such of a life of their own that attracts people, even young people. And maybe they don't even know why they're attracted to the building, but there's just something about these houses that's magnetic.
Exactly. And again, I had a wonderful tour at the Bradley House. I also visited the Dana Thomas House this summer, and I don't think I have had anything resembling the same tour twice in the many years that I've gone to visit it. And again, a rather eccentric character, Susan Lawrence Dana. Yeah. For anyone really interested in absorbing turn-of-the-century Illinois history, we're concentrating on the buildings today, but beyond that, these houses are wonderful. And I think, again, Tom, you've brought out how strikingly different these houses are, and you have as well, Elizabeth. There are stories of people just really being halfway scared of the houses and the occupants.
Oh, definitely.
Because they were so bizarre.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think is most interesting is when the Hickoxes and the Bradleys put these projects out to bid in the local community, Mr. Hickox recalled many years later that they couldn't get a contractor to bid on the projects. They were so unique and so, like Tom says, very futuristic to these, you know, even the building techniques, the contractors didn't want to touch them. And they were finally done by a contractor named Charles Childs, who was a local contractor who we don't know a lot about, but he did use local craftsmen. And, you know, a lot of the work was done by local people. And I tell people all the time that both of these houses are the story of people taking chances.
Oh, absolutely.
The Bradleys took a chance on Wright. Wright took a chance on the design. The contractor took a chance on being able to complete the design. And then throughout the years, people have taken chances on this house. And the Halls really took a chance in 2005 that following a major restoration that they would be able to put it into public hands. And then our group of volunteers really took a leap of faith that we could make it happen.
Thank goodness for enlightened patronage. We have a call now from Lovington. Good morning.
Good morning. Hello?
Yes, we're here. Yes, go right ahead, please. Yeah.
Did this house overrun cost like some of Wright's houses? Or do you know?
We really don't know a lot about the cost and the overrun, especially, as Tom pointed out, because there wasn't a lot of press, period press at the time. We think the house cost about $9,000 to build. I know there's a note on the plans that says that the stable and breezeway were not included in the original plan, but they were part of the project and they were completed at the same time. So I would assume that means that they didn't run over too much on the house, or they wouldn't have been able to complete the breezeway and the stable. But we just really don't know.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the thing about overrunning what the original estimate was is something that's come up over and over on Frank Lloyd Wright buildings. My attitude towards Frank Lloyd Wright is that he is one of the world's greatest salesmen of all time and could charm these people into spending more and more and more money, because it's ultimately the owner, the client, that's the one that's writing the checks. And if they don't want to write the check for this, they won't do it. And so in spite of someone saying, well, the house was estimated at $50,000 and it came out at $125,000, well, the owners said, okay, let's do it. And Frank Lloyd Wright said, there's nothing to make people work hard like a mortgage.
Well, we all know that, I think.
But the cost overrun, the people went along with it. And Frank Lloyd Wright maybe was able to sell them on a larger and larger and larger house, knowing full well that when they pay off the mortgage, assuming they stay there a long period of time, what the original mortgage was will be a pittance by the time they sell it off. I think that's still true today.
We have an email here asking mentioning that the website for KankakeeWright.org shows tours only through the last week in September. What do you plan for the future, Elizabeth?
I plan to update the website in the future. This is a volunteer effort, and unfortunately, we just haven't gotten through that. But the hours that are posted on the website will continue through October and into the winter. So I will update that.
Very good for you. And you're also looking for volunteers? How might someone get involved with it?
Absolutely. If you go to our website, you can email us at info@wrightandkankakee.org. And we are holding another training for docents on October 10th at 3:30. That's a Sunday from 3:30 to 5. There's lots of other ways to volunteer, though. We are always looking for folks to help out in the yard and in the stable shop and with general maintenance and publications. We really would like to do a very nice, slick newsletter, and so we need some folks to help us with that. There's lots of ways to volunteer. So just shoot us an email, and we will get you on the list.
The original name for this building, and I don't know where the name came from, was Glenn Lloyd. And according to the description published in 1902, there was a small glen at the rear along the river. And it looks from the photographs and from the descriptions that there was groups of willows and other trees back there, and then, pardon me, up where the road is, where Harrison Street is, again along the river. And so I think one of the things in their long-term plan is to put some of these native species back in there.
Definitely.
So gardeners, I think people willing to do some back-breaking work are always helpful.
And nursery owners who are willing to donate trees.
Super. Once again, our topic today is Frank Lloyd Wright. I'm with Elizabeth Dunbar and Thomas Hines. And if you'd like to join in our conversation, you may phone 244-9455. And we also are available by email, WILL at Let's see. It's WILL-talk@illinois.edu. Certainly also there's the 800 number, 800-222-9455. Back to you, Tom. Frank Lloyd Wright is described by Ada Louise Huxtable. She has an interesting new biography out on him as a magpie. He looked at everything, thought about everything. What sort of diverse influences do you see pretty clearly here in the Bradley House?
Well, the first thing that I see is Oriental influence. He had not yet been to Japan. He went to Japan for the first time in 1904 with his clients from Highland Park, the Willetses. But his first employer in Chicago, Joseph Lyman Silsby, was a collector of Japanese prints. Some of those prints showed buildings, and simple stucco buildings with wood trim and wood windows and some kind of pattern where the windows or the openings are. And I think that was influential. There was a Japanese pavilion at the World's Fair of 1893 in Chicago. The main building for the Japanese exhibit, which is not shown very often, is almost a dead ringer for his first independent house, the Winslow House in River Forest up near Elk Park. And so I think that was very influential in his work. But also a man named William Morris from England was trying to get back to a simpler time, not quite as ostentatious and gaudy as the Victorians would do. They would decorate everything and do turn spindles and just textures all over the place. And he was trying to simplify that, giving what he called a quiet line. And I see that in the house also, very much so.
You know, when you look at the variety of building forms that influenced Frank Lloyd Wright, it just looks like a mishmash. It looks like a very, very bad grocery list. And when you see the homes, everything is so well synthesized, so well integrated that, you know, when you've had a little bit of art history, art appreciation, you begin to decipher what you're seeing. But it is remarkably Frank Lloyd Wright and no one else. He even goes well beyond Louis Sullivan, and I admire Sullivan greatly, but the refinement, the elegance. And it's so wonderful we can see so much of this in Illinois.
Definitely.
Two and a half hour drives, and it's
amazing.
Just there for us.
And you mentioned the house that you are a docent at.
Oh, yes. That's tomorrow's show, the Farnsworth House.
The Farnsworth. And Dana, and then, you know, obviously Oak Park and Roby are just a stone's throw. And it's amazing to me the influences that Tom mentioned. But in addition to that, of course, Wright was greatly influenced by nature. And that's one of the things that I see in our house so clearly is his appreciation for and how in tune with nature he was and makes the living spaces in tune with nature as well. As I mentioned, a view of the river from almost every room in the house.
Right. Very reverent, very devout
very
attention
much so.
To nature. We do have a caller from Ferryberry. Good morning.
Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
I didn't know if you were had talked about the Frank Lloyd Wright House in Oregon in terms of people getting upset if they were going to tear it down and all those things. The house he built or had built in Oregon designed was going to be torn down. It was in a kind of a suburb of Portland, and people got upset, and so they cut it into four pieces and moved it 40 miles to Silverton.
You're familiar with that, Elizabeth?
I believe you're talking about the Gordon House.
Yes, yeah, Gordon House.
Yes.
I believe that was the name. And we went through it about a month ago, and really something. But they have a video on picking the house up in four parts and hauling it down the road. It was very interesting.
And that is an amazing story. The lengths that people will go to save these right structures is just incredible. And along with that goes some controversy about the site and whether and what do you take, what do you lose when you take this structure out of the context in which Wright designed it? And I think, you know, if our house was picked up and moved somewhere else, it wouldn't have the same effect as it does at the site. And obviously, you know, saving it is a priority, but, you know, there are things about the adjacencies and the site itself that you lose when you do that. And so it is very contentious whenever there's a situation like that. But the Gordon House has done a beautiful job. They have a beautiful piece of property, and they've done an amazing job at taking that house and reframing it and reciting it. It's just beautiful. I don't know.
The Roby House was going to be torn down in 1957.
Mm-hmm. Oh, goodness.
While Franklin Wright was still alive. And he made a plea for it not to be torn down. But Walter Kreese, who was a professor at University of Illinois in the Architectural History Department, they had planned on taking the house, a brick house, putting it on some flat cars on the Illinois Central, moving it down to the University of Illinois.
Oh, no. That's just, that's giving us all headaches.
And they were going to put it out near the Morrow Plot.
Well, you know, we'd love to have it close by, but no, not relocated. In reality, that would be very bad.
So ultimately, it was saved and preserved in its original context, except now the house that was north of it is gone, and this smaller building that the University of Chicago owned has been torn down, and this great big huge thing has been built across the street, so it's kind of losing its context.
We have another caller this morning from Ashcombe. Good morning, caller.
Yeah, good morning. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Hope I'm coming through okay on my cell phone. I'm just going to make this quick. There is a Wright-inspired home just built in the last 10 years west of Ashcombe on Illinois 116, designed by a graduate from the University of Illinois. Just something that somebody could see. If they're traveling to Kankakee from either Chicago or Champaign, just wanted to share that with you guys.
Well, thank you very much for that tip. It's always delightful to see not only how Wright interpreted other architects, but how other architects interpret Wright. And, Tom, maybe you'd want to take this. I mean, my thought is, how relevant is Wright today? Now we're in the 21st century. What is the meaning of Frank Lloyd Wright for architects such as yourself?
I think he was one of the original green architects, as they call it today.
Definitely.
The Roby House being an example we refer to frequently in this program. In the winter, the overhang in the front or the south side of the building allows the sun to completely fill the entire structure. It goes all the way across the living room. And in the summer, the sun is much higher, and the sun does not enter the building. So it keeps it out. Also, below each of the double doors, the French doors that go out to a small balcony to the south side, in the floor below a grate are radiators. And Frank Lloyd Wright was very interested in radiant heat, which is a very good heat. The air temperature in a building only has to be in the 60s to be very comfortable, because when your feet are warm, you feel warm. And I've been in some of his buildings when it's been 10 below zero outside, and the floor is 80 degrees. My feet are feeling that, and yet the air temperature was only 62. So he did in 1942, he did what he called a solar hemicycle, so that the radiant heat would come in and heat the dark red concrete floor, which would radiate the heat back at night. I mean, he was, and he did, and he had berms on the north side of this building to insulate most of the building, although there's a row of windows on top, and protect it from the north wind.
I almost don't want to get into this late in the program, but Tom, you have mentioned before that Wright made no design errors. Am I correct?
Oh, no.
Okay, then I understood you wrong.
I wouldn't go that far at all.
Okay, okay.
There's always something, and one of the things that I've learned about Frank Lloyd Wright over the years is using the term always and never
good.
In relation to him is extremely dicey.
But contractors did have difficulty interpreting what he wanted. So some of the problems, for example, it's my understanding at Falling Water, the huge restoration that had to go on there, 10 years ago or so, that was really, in large part, a misunderstanding of Wright's design as the building went up.
I think that the contractor, and I knew the Frank Lloyd Wright never went to that building during construction, which is, I think, pretty amazing. But the kids that he sent out there, and they were, 17, 18, 19 years old, they understood that the contractor didn't have much faith in that building, really wasn't paying very good attention. And, in fact, inside some of those concrete walls, he allowed the insulation to get wet. Now, that causes two problems. One is mold, but the other is it rusts the reinforcing inside the concrete. And it also, when it freezes, it expands and gives hairline cracks. Ultimately, that's what caused the problem out there.
Well, fortunately, it's beautiful and open for tours. Again, I understand.
Yes.
I mean, no problem with that. As is the Bradley House in Kankakee. My guests today have been Elizabeth Dunbar from Wright in Kankakee and Thomas A. Hines, a writer, photographer, architect who's devoted his career to the buildings of Frank Lloyd Wright. Thank you very much for listening to Focus today.